This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. And if you've heard me talk about Grammy, you know that she means the world to me. I wanted a dog for probably 10 years, and I was living in an apartment, couldn't have dogs. When I finally moved somewhere else, I adopted her within weeks, and it was love at first scritch. She's about 2 feet away from me as I record this. She hangs out in the studio, and all I want to do is smooch her and look at her and stare at her. I also like feeding her because I see how happy it makes her. And there's nothing like watching her lick her chops after having yummy stuff like Grammy's Paw Pie or Real Texas Beef and Sweet Potato, which are two recipes she's been enjoying from Merrick. As her parent, I like that they use deboned meat and fish or poultry as the number one ingredient. I also like that they have these real ingredients and you can see them on the bag so you know what's in each one. And watching her do a little dance, especially with a Grammy's Pot Pie recipe, brings too much joy to my heart. Is there such a thing as too much joy? I'm not sure. But check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Oh, hey, it's still that throwback picture from when you wore baggy jeans and shell necklaces. Allie Ward back with part two of a pop cultural and psychological episode y'all loved the start of last week. So we're going to finish it off with more of your great questions, shall we? We shall. Okay, so if you have not listened to last week, you want to hop over to part one first. You'll hear the definition of phanthropology from an actual living, breathing researcher whose Twitter bio reads, "Phanthropologist, entertainment futurist, YouTube enthusiast, and defender of teen girl taste." So in part one, we covered sports and religion and K-pop goblins for good and the practice of Disney bounding, which I completely failed to ever define. It's subtly dressing like Disney characters in the theme parks in a way that only other Disney fanatics might catch. That's Disney bounding. We talked about fan fiction and Frasier and how complex and kind of evil algorithms tell us what to like. We talk about free-range children, what to do if your favorite author turns out to be problematic, and more. So that is part one. In this episode, we're going to hear about shipping, which is short for relationshipping, I suppose, or dreaming up unions that exist only in your horny daydreams, and fans versus stans being kind of the creepy variety, and the line between cults and fandoms, and the all-important question of, if you want to build an empire and fandom over which you preside, how do you become internet famous? Do you want to be internet famous? All that and more. A quick thanks first to all the listeners of Ologies. I could not do these interviews or make the show without the wonderfully weird and insightful questions from patrons. You can give a dollar or more a month to support the show at patreon.com/ologies, as well as all the folks who just spread the word and the links and leave reviews. I creep on you, and I read every single one. And this week, thank you to Trisha S. and also Bronze Kraken, aka PD, who wrote, "Dearest Father, I hope this letter finds you well. I have verily enjoyed your audio recordings. I listen to each new one with gusto and look forward to the next. Your internet child, PD." See? Proof. So leave one. Okay, everyone else who left one, I read it for sure, and your weird internet uncle dad hearts you very much and is earnestly so happy you're here. Okay, let's shove off into part two of Phanthropology with behavioral researcher and legit professional on her business card, unironically, phanthropologist Meredith Levine. I'm going to make us go through Patreon questions because there are questions I want to ask you that patrons asked. And so I'm going to ask it their questions through my mouth. Is that cool?
Great.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. This one was at the top of my tongue and it was asked by patrons Anna Thompson, El McCall, Matt Ciccato, Island Helly, Bonnie, Tamara Mann, Carrie, Caitlin Powell, Anya, Levi Burke, Hope, Lexi Reitz, Rachel Weiss, Lee Catherine Earhart, and John McClain. All kind of wanted to know about obsessive fandom. Bonnie asked, what's the line between being a healthy fan of something and obsession? And Tamara wants to know, when does fandom cross the line to inappropriate and healthy? And then also a stan. When does a fan become a stan?
Good question.
So let's start with obsessive.
Okay.
Fandom has historically been pathologized.
Okay.
In a negative way.
Yeah.
And fans generally aren't that.
Aww.
They are generally not malicious. And when does it become unhealthy?
Mm-hmm.
It becomes unhealthy when you neglect all of the things in your life that actually lead to a healthy life, like eating and sleeping and like going to work and or school. But like, who's to say what a good use of time is, especially in an age where one can be a professional fan if like that's the thing you want to do? When does it become unhealthy? When your life and relationships suffer as a result.
Right.
Plenty of people have found their life partners and like gotten married and stuff through fandom. And that's a thing that happens now.
Mm-hmm.
And by fandom, I mean like pop culture fandom, fandom with like a capital F. So that's not necessarily unhealthy. What is unhealthy is when you have the rogue person, and this happens a lot in like influencer culture and those kinds of fandoms, because this particular type of object of fandom is themselves
yeah.
for a living. Where I'm friends with a bunch of creators as a offshoot of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes they get the question of like, what's the weirdest thing a fan has ever done?
Yeah.
Or what's like the scariest or creepiest or whatever. And that is when it gets to be scary and creepy and bad, is in those in-person interactions for the most part of like screaming at someone in Target or like going and waiting outside of their house. Anything that is a breach of personal privacy for the object of fandom is when it gets to be bad, because then it's like actively dehumanizing to those people who are objects of fandom.
But wouldn't some people argue that they have taken themselves out of being a human and been striving for something like superhuman, where they are getting more than a normal human's share of attention or wealth or privilege? So, I mean, and I'm saying this as someone who also knows a lot of creators and is a creator. Is there anything where there's been a consensus that you have surrendered your privacy by selling it?
No. In my opinion, everyone is entitled to their privacy in as much of it as they want.
Cool.
That being said, it's also important for objects of fandom to understand that and be a little bit more careful with their personal information. In the event that you are an object of fandom or want to be an object of fandom, step one is cultivate an audience. But in that process, people with kids have to make the decision how much of their kids' lives are part of their brands. And that's a personal decision, especially if their kids are too young to like consent to that. And there are choices that everyone has to make about like how much of their personal lives they want to show. And celebrities deal with this also. It's a little bit less of an issue when you're a non-human entity with mm-hmm. fans.
I'm hoping she means
non-human entity.
Like Gritty, the floopy, grumpy, flaming orange figurehead of the Philadelphia Flyers, who has been described by newspapers as, quote, an acid trip of a mascot and a ghastly, empty-eyed Muppet. So neither human nor beast, Gritty was born in 2018 out of the design prompt, something you'd high-five but not hug. And sure, I did go down a rabbit hole looking at pictures of Gritty tattoos, such as one bearing the words, chaos reigns.
Chaos reigns.
But even still, like, showing up to a place of home or work is when it gets to be obsessive and bad.
Right.
Which is not the same thing as a toxic fandom.
Yeah, can we talk about toxic fandoms? Because patrons Mike Monikowski, Samantha Ryan, Jesse Dragon, Anna Thompson, Justin McCormick, and Colleeny B, also Will Johnston, wanted to know. Will Johnston asked, what in your opinion is the most toxic fandom? And also, what's the best fandom and why is it Terry Pratchett's Disco World? Or Discworld? I thought I said Disco World. And I was like, that sounds tight. But I guess Discworld, maybe that's Frisbee. I don't know.
I earnestly thought that Discworld was similar to Terry Bradshaw's NFL video game, but with Ultimate Frisbee. And then I realized that it's actually John Madden's NFL game. Anyway, Discworld is a series of novels set in a flat world, perched on the back of four giant elephants, perched on a giant turtle. It was written not by NFL coach Terry Bradshaw, but by literary figure Sir Terry Pratchett. My point is that Discworld fandom has nothing to do with sports or disco pantsuits.
I would totally go to Disco World, by the way.
Me too, dude.
I would love it there. So what is the most toxic fandom?
Yeah. Like, what is toxic fandom? Like, when does it become shitty? Because I'm trying to think of, like, all I can think about are, like, people who are out in 30-degree weather with no shirt on and their body painted sports colors. And I'm sure that that is, like, not even toxic compared to what is out there.
That's just uncomfortable fandoms.
So, like, generally when people refer to toxic fandoms, they refer to intra-fandom fighting with ad hominem attacks and actively like shutting other people down and yucking their yums and generally being like know-it-alls, wet blankets, gatekeepers, and like shunning and shaming people who like the same things. So when those kinds of tools get used within a fandom, or like when actions are taken against marginalized identities or those are not respected, oftentimes that is another thing that's referenced as a toxic fandom. I'm all for sports fans who go shirtless in the middle of winter to paint their bodies. Like, you do you, your body, whatever. I'm not going to tell you to put on a sweater, but kink shame someone for their fan fiction, which also came up a lot. And that's kind of bad. Or like telling someone that they don't belong or that they're not fan enough. Everyone starts as a beginner. And just because someone doesn't have the same fandom origin story as someone else doesn't necessarily make them less of a fan or less of a worthy fan.
So do other fans call newbies posers? That's a little toxic. Now, confession, I have actually never seen Rocky Horror Picture Show live because I heard that they write a V for virgin on your forehead if you've never been, like with lipstick. And I think that's good natured and not toxic. But I was so afraid of getting a constellation of pimples in a V on my forehead, on my bad teen skin. So I chickened out at every opportunity to attend a midnight fishnetted screening. But yes, fandoms in which people genuinely, not good-naturedly harass each other, those are the bad ones.
Sometimes it happens also when there are ship wars that happen. And like there are two dominant ships that come to the forefront of the fandom and they actively like don't believe and are against each other, which is its whole, shipping culture is its whole other, it's part of fandom with a capital F, but it's this whole other thing. And if you want to know a lot more about fan fiction and shipping culture and that kind of fandom, fandom with a capital F, I highly recommend the Fansplaining podcast with Flourish Klink and Elizabeth Minkle. Great podcast if you're interested in capital F fandom.
Well, you know, dovetailing off of that, listeners, Diane Bao, Taryn Fernatz, Kelly Seaman, and Jamie Kishimoto. Jamie had a great question and asked, have you done any studies on the phenomenon of queerbaiting and how it creates diehard fandoms of shippers but never delivers a happy queer ending?
I would say never say never. The media landscape is shifting and we have an example of that recently. But my guess is there's a specific IP behind this and my hunch is that it might be Teen Wolf.
Okay, so I looked this up, and the MTV series Teen Wolf debuted in 2011, and I'm going to quote an article from The Advocate to sum up the beef with the beefy but ultimately empty romance arcs. So The Advocate said, the continued teases that a character might be bisexual with no payoff, the same-sex romances that end as quickly as they begin, the disappearance of gay characters without explanation, and the absence of any well-developed LGBT character four seasons into a show that appeared to bank heavily on its queer appeal early on have left vocal fans howling, end quote. And though its final season was in 2017, many moons ago, history remembers Teen Wolf as kind of a hairy situation.
Ooh!
And I personally think that queerbaiting is exploitative, as are a lot of the tropes that get used, like barrier gaze and fridging and that sort of thing that shows historically have used. And I think that as queer voices become more prominent in writers' rooms and in the production process, I think that will happen less and less, especially since fans also can take collective action and do grassroots like awareness of what these issues are and why it's harmful. Having very coded behavior is also very typically Hollywood and stems from like a very long history of what was acceptable on in film and television by those standards and like Hays Code stuff, what it means to get like a rating for PG-13 versus R.
Hays Codes, side note, I looked it up, were essentially written in the late 1920s by a Jesuit priest and a church elder as a sort of code of standards for the motion picture industry. And it set precedents forbidding all kinds of fun stuff, such as nudity, suggestive dancing, discussions of sexual perversity, any ridicule of religion, any interracial relationships, lustful kissing, and any scenes of passion. Obviously, this was not friendly to any queer depictions or werewolf makeouts, to say the least.
There's a lot of institutionalized things to unpack around queerbaiting, because to attribute it to a writer's room isn't entirely the whole story, and to attribute it to a marketing team isn't entirely the whole story. In my opinion, it's unfortunate, but also tends to draw out people who are like-minded and want to go into that level of imagining. I don't love it, but also the effects of it have done community building things. So a lot of the times why queer ships exist is because there aren't as many well-rounded characters to imagine and reimagine and reshape that are women and non-binary and on the other gender spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood is still incredibly male dominated.
Yeah.
When it comes to playing around with characters, often the best ones are guys.
Mm. That's interesting. That's such a good point. So because movies and TV and comic books seem to be well stocked on man people in general, those lead characters are fleshed out with more complexity, and so they get shipped more often in fan fantasies, because who wants to ship a boring character? It's like trying to make a sexy sandwich with one soggy bread slice. No, thank you. Give me two nutty, rich, tangy slices. I don't care what gender they are. Now, on the topic of that. And kind of off of that, listener Sylvia Sharf had a question. They wrote, people talk about fangirling or fanboying over a person. What is the gender-neutral term for this behavior? It isn't fanning. Signed, a gender person who definitely does this thing, but is neither a girl nor a boy.
So, if I had to remove gender from it, I would say fanning out as a phrase.
Okay.
I'm fanning out. But fangirling and fanboying often, like, have implied different sets of behaviors.
Okay.
Regardless of gender, but having to do with typically masculine and typically feminine traits based on their portrayals in the media.
Right.
So, like, when I hear fangirling, I hear a sound.
Yes. Oh, of course. Of course.
And I'm sure everyone hears the sound of, like, this high pit. It's a squee, S-Q-U-E-E, and it's a sound. And I hear, like, Beatlemania and crying and fainting, and a lot of it is associated with proximity to object of fandom.
Yes, yes.
versus like being a fanboy, I ascribe to, regardless of gender, slightly more pedantic behavior. And the behavior of like nerd jocking.
Yeah.
Or true fanning, which is quizzing people and having all the information. And there's a very outdated model about affirmational and transformational fandom that was like an academic paper from like, I think maybe the late 90s, possibly the early 2000s, about ways that fandom, capital F, express themselves. And some is in transformation and some is in completionism of like, are you reimagining and playing with the work? The work is a springboard for one's own imagination. Or is it more encyclopedic and religious where like it's about knowing everything? And, like, being an expert in the thing.
So transformational fandom is like, hey, thanks for making this world, these characters, as fans, it's now ours to run with and make more elaborate and weirder if we want to. But affirmational fandom is like, this is what the creator intended, and we may only observe and fawn over and memorize this particular world and characters. Also, if you like video games, name all the video games.
And so these conflicting models of like what people think of as fans can often inhibit the experience of being one, because the one of the other questions that gets asked a lot is like, do you have to be part of a community to be a fan? And the answer is no. You can be a fan all on your own and like do whatever it is that you do and not interact with a soul around it and still be a good fan, because being a fan is something that one imagines themselves to be, not like a set of behaviors.
Mm. And but we would call that in general fanning out.
Fanning out.
I like fanning out.
If there's a gender neutral term for having an overwhelming moment of excitement as a result of something having to do with the object of fandom,
mm-hmm.
that makes oneself sensorily overloaded or sensorily like frozen, I would call it fanning out.
I love it. I love it. And on the topic of forging ahead with neologisms, which is a word that I can never say. Neologism? Neologism? New words?
I've only read it.
Neologism.
Anna Thompson and Forstots had questions. Do people typically connect more with podcasts than other types of media because listening is more intimate?
Oh, thank you for your podcast voice. I love this ASMR moment. There are a lot of things that have to do with connecting with podcast hosts. Part of it has to do with being in someone's ears and how intimate actually talking is, especially in the age of like visuals and texting.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it has to do with how much time podcasters spend in the ears of their fans. It's somewhere between 20 minutes and an hour or two a week, depending on what kind of podcast you're listening to. And it's like every week.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a friend. This is a familiar voice. It's the kind of experience you put on to be a little less alone,
mm-hmm.
whilst doing something else, like driving or dishes or laundry or going on a walk. The dedicated podcast listening, high fidelity style of this is all I'm doing. I'm sitting and I'm listening to my voice or whatever, a little less prevalent behaviorally, but there is a lot of familiarity, assuming that the library can sustain that. Most podcasts don't make it over 10 episodes.
Really?
Yeah, a lot fail in the first 90 days and we'll have a season, but to be able to sustain and develop an audience in podcast form often requires a lot of dedication to the format and ability to do so. And there are a lot of people who dabble. As the podcast scene gets more robust, there are more podcasts that can't go on indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, like there is a certain level of intimacy that is similar to vloggers because of the amount of time that this person as themselves spends with the audience. It's a very audience inclusive format. And so, yes, there is a great reason as to why podcast hosts have fandom in a way that feels a little bit more friendly than Jared Padalecki, which is beautiful and a lot easier under the like independent creator model than it is to do when you are a major studio with like a massive legal team and like all sorts of issues, like with including any idea that didn't come out of the writer's room. Like, there are a lot of infrastructural reasons why big studios can't do what podcasters do.
Mm. I know. I never thought that I would love this medium as much as I do. It's just been so rewarding, I think, because of that connection to listeners. And I have said before, and even more so now that we are in an era of not in-person weddings, but if two ologites met through the show and get married, I am a Universal Life Church minister. I will be happy to Zoom marry you.
Marriage is what brings us together today.
I feel like it is my duty.
You heard it here, ologites. You heard it here. Do you want Dad Ward to marry you two? All you have to do is meet somebody and then fall in love and then decide to get married.
There is an Ologies Facebook singles group. I think it's called Flirty Ologites or Flirtology, one of those, but I'll put it in an aside. Please see the Facebook group Flirtology Singles, quote, a place for ologites and other nerds, geeks, dweebs, wonks, and boffins to meet, mingle, flirt, chat, and canoodle. There's 908 hot dorks waiting for you. So maybe this is the universe, aka me, telling you to maybe join. Text a crush about the bangs you just cut. We're all gonna die anyway. Just take a chance.
Also, quick ad break right now. A double donation was made to the Project for Awesome, thanks to sponsors of the show, and links to sponsors and to that charity are in the show notes.
What do you get for the mom who birthed you into the world? I know, a candle. Are you like, no, that's not quite enough. How about memories that she'll love looking at every day? Aura frames? I love them. So they're a digital photo frame. They were named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and by me. And Aura frames are Wi-Fi connected. You can add unlimited photos and videos, and you can invite as many people as you want to the frame. There are absolutely no hidden fees. There's no subscriptions. You can also react with cute emojis if you'd like, and you can show you love a photo. You can send congratulations or more. It's so wonderful that A, it's not a candle, and also it's not sharing your photos on social media to look at. It's just there. You can share it with the people who you love. I have mentioned this so many times, but my parents have an Aura that I got them. My dad loved that. I have gotten Aura frames for friends, for family members of friends. So I'm a really big fan of them. I love what they do. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. So that's AuraFrames.com. Use the code Ologies at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. I love these things.
This podcast and my life is brought to you by Squarespace. Do you know that I didn't have a website for forever because I was putting it off because I was scared? And then I heard another podcast talk about Squarespace. I was like, I'm going to give it a shot. I had a website up that day. They have beautiful templates. They host. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Look at me. Even I did it. You can sell products. You can sell your time. They have this guided design system. It's called Squarespace Blueprint. You can select from a layout. There are styling options. You can get your website discovered with these integrated, optimized SEO tools so people find you when they Google. They also have easy to use payment tools. So checkout, very easy for customers, which is what you want. There's also Squarespace AI, which can help you explain what your site is about. You can choose your tone. Whether you're a scientist who wants to share your work with the world, whether you are starting up a business selling tiny paintings of tiny bugs, or a choreographer selling dance classes, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/ologies to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. I recommend it to all my friends, even when I'm not recording an ad. Okay. Hi, I'm the person whose closet is put in color order, but I'll also pick up an earthworm without thinking twice. In fact, I did yesterday. It needed my help. I'm not afraid to be a little messy. Human nature is messy, but nature can help us embrace it. I love the brand Seventh Generation. Their laundry detergent lifts away tough stains with the power of bioenzymes. That's exciting. You wipe your hands on your pants after you pick up an earthworm? Seventh Generation is like, don't worry. Hug a dirty tree. Huff some bark. It's good for you. That is the power of Seventh Generation. Find laundry detergent and other laundry products at seventhgeneration.com. I love worms. I know I usually save my secrets for the end of the episode, but I'm going to tell you my secret favorite candy. It's Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. It's really Reese's anything, but Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the thing that I'm like, have I had a bad day? I get these. Have I had a good day? I get these. Chocolate, salty peanut butter, the textures. I love everything about them. Also that there's two. So I'm like, oh, I get this one for later, which is 1 second later. Anyway, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I love you. That's all. If you're me, you can shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you. Found wherever candy is sold. And I am.
Okay, I think we were talking about, yes, flirtology singles.
So if you're single and you like learning things about slug dicks, let me hook you up with someone. A lot of people asked about the positives and benefits of certain fandoms. Bailey Sperling, letters from Eleanor Rigby, which is a great name, Gary Simo, Kathleen Sachs, Natalie Rhodes, and Kim Boniker all kind of asked, like, what's the most moving thing you've ever seen a group of fans do for someone else, or what's been the most wholesome view of the world? What kinds of experiences have really touched you?
What's having a moment this year, which is a really beautiful thing to watch, is fans rallying together to be pro-social with causes and to actively help shape the world. Like, there is this budding form of activism called fan activism. And one of my favorite instances is the Project for Awesome, which has been going on for like over 10 years now, which is a Nerdfighter John and Hank thing, but extends to their larger network of creators. That actually started as like an algorithmic hack to get on the front page of YouTube back when that was a thing, and is now a major fundraising for charity experience. The fandoms do all sorts of beautiful things. There's a great book called Will the Vampire People Please Leave the Lobby about fans funding other Buffy fans in like the 90s to like get them plane tickets and get them to like fan meetups. I've seen K-pop fans doing some great work this season. There are a lot of Twitch streamers and gamers who do a lot of fundraising for charity. St. Jude is a recipient for a lot of those. There's a lot of beautiful stuff that happens when you can get a community together and move them in a positive direction. Like, what I'm really enjoying right now is the community of people on TikTok who are building the Ratatouille musical.
Is it cast with real rats? Please say yes.
No. No, but it's this beautiful work of, like, collaborative creativity.
So this was recorded in December, side note, out of order with the rats episode, which you may reference if you would like to know all about rodents and Ratatouille TikTok musicals, and also hear a career rodentologist talk about the zaniest things he's seen a rat abscond with. Also, I do break down into tears about rats giving each other presents, like a chewed on biscuit or a dead moth. That's normal. Everything's fine.
Are there any thoughts that you have about fandom being cultish or religious? A ton of listeners who I will say their names in an aside.
Your names, my mouth. Let's do it. Tony Jane, Kat Lindsay, Regan L. Hereford, Hillary Larson, Ashley Scribner, Sharika Alahi, Kathleen Sachs, and Amber Lee Noel.
Or are those just so different in severity and harm and emotional impact that they're not even comparable?
Oh, I mean, if you are cutting off all of your social ties and devoting all of your financial capital to a fandom, it's probably a cult.
Okay.
But... outside of those contexts, communities develop language and rituals all the time. And if your ritual is, you know, buy yourself a dozen roses and have your girlfriends over once a week to watch The Bachelorette.
I mean, I don't want to be a cliche, but I'm not here to make friends.
Ritual, not cult.
Okay.
Which, admirable ritual. Buy yourself a dozen roses every week.
Why
that
not?
Is a great treat. Why not?
Meredith Ever, the anthropologist, says that from a community evolutionary perspective, we as big bald apes are constantly trying to find who is chill and who is sus. And when fandoms get too large, like even over 200 people in a group, it's scary for us to trust each other. So people get bitchy. Folks begin to bicker, sub-fandoms schism off based on who they ship or maybe what seasons or franchises they like more.
Are they cults? Mostly not. again, if you or someone you know is cutting off everybody who doesn't belong and also devoting all of their financial resources to this outside organization, probably a cult. Most fandoms are not. In fact, I can't really think of a fandom that is, aside from occasional like actual cults of personality, in which case they're small but hold a lot of weight,
mm-hmm.
or religions like Scientology, which are large and hold a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do religions offspring off of objects of fandom and like works of science fiction? Scientology is an example of that happening. So it could happen.
Mm-hmm.
it's not outside the realm of possibility.
Scientology episode, anyone? JK, I'm too scared.
And, you know, those are based on science fiction books, Scientology in particular. And that one last Patreon question I have to ask are so many. Hannah, Miss Kitty, Monica, first-time question asker, Irina DeZazzo, Caitlin Powell, Monica, Aviva Elizabeth, Paulina Krasinka, Samantha Ryan, Jolanta Banal, Lauren Mascabrota, Deborah Bowden, and Samantha Steelman all had questions about fan fiction. And they wanted to know, Monica asked, what is the academic discussion surrounding fan fiction writing? Are they taken seriously in academic context? And Arena is a first-time question asker and wants to know just what your thoughts are. When does it cross the line from creative expression to privacy invasion?
I have never had fan fiction written about me, so I don't have a lot of experience about privacy invasion, but a lot of it is imaginings rather than spying on someone.
Mm-hmm.
academia takes fan fiction very seriously.
Does it really?
It's a very interesting subject of research for a lot of people. It blends into fan labor discussions. It blends into representation discussions. There are a lot of people who have done math and like quantitative analyses of the fan fiction landscapes. It blends into like legal challenges. Like, it's a really interesting space for fan studies, and it's a really interesting place to be, which is one of the reasons I think it's so heavily associated with the idea of fandom.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a delight. I used to read a lot of it.
Aww.
I read less of it now, mostly because time and tastes change and the fandoms that I'm interested in reading about, like the kinds of fic I want, isn't necessarily the kinds of fic that's prolific, because I want like story continuity fics. Like right now I'm starting to hunt down fic for The Magicians because that series ended, and I really just want more of those characters and of that world, and it left on a really great like new beginning ending rather than like everything that had to have been said was said ending. So like there was a lot of negative space in that show for imagining, and I really am like interested in that. But fic is also really heavily into like, it crosses over heavily into shipping, although not all fic is shipping by any means, and not all shipping happens in fic by mm-hmm. any means. And erotica and sex positivity. There are all sorts of genres that people may take some sort of issue with, like real person fic or dubcon or noncon.
Just a quick jargon rundown. Fanfic, again, is fan fiction. Shipping, once again, creating relationships. And dubcon and noncon, I had to look it up, and it means portraying sexual elements of dubious consent or non-consent. So, of course, fan fiction about real people and depictions of violence are areas people get understandably squicky about.
But one of the things about fan fiction and one of the interesting things about the internet is, like, when fan fiction was happening, there was almost no way that an object of fandom would read it. Writers' rooms can't, because they can't risk ideas from fic.
Mm.
They can't risk the idea of, like, idea theft.
Yeah.
So, like, writers for writers' rooms can't read fic for their own series. Or typically can't. I only know a few writers, but that's generally the operating procedure. Which isn't to say that authors don't write fic, and, like, writers and writers don't write fic. They do, but, like, under pseudonyms and stuff like that, because of the way that like intellectual property works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fascinating because you can see the most interesting characters are male. It's very, very white. It's a microcosm of the internet more broadly, where there are issues of representation and issues of expression and issues of labor. Like, it's just a beautiful little microcosm of all of the other issues that as a society we're dealing with today.
Mm-hmm.
In this of varying quality, nichified experience for people who want that. So I'm very pro fanfiction, even though I don't read a lot of it.
So fanfiction is a way to create art that perhaps breaks the bounds of what a lot of typical mainstream studio entertainment looks like, where executives have to answer to shareholders and corporations rely on a few big tentpole movies to keep the whole studio standing. And fanfiction doesn't have those restrictions. Anything can happen in your own word processing doc or notebook. So creators are kind of like, y'all dream up whatever you want, but your tweets are not going to influence what I want to write. My very, very good friend, Daylin Rodriguez, is a showrunner for the show Queen of the South, and she says her DMs get filled with people sending their opinions on storylines and relationships between characters. She doesn't even open them. She appreciates the enthusiasm, but doesn't engage because she has a whole show to run.
Being good on Twitter is its own skill.
I know.
Not all creators of objects of fandom have any interest or ability to be objects of fandom themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, like, respecting the creative process, I think, happens, is, like, one of the other things that happens a lot is a lot of fan entitlement of, like, there's a balance between the creative process and what audiences want. And it's a lot easier for independent creators to give audiences more of what they want. But there's also that Ford quote of, like, if I asked the people what they want, they would have said faster horses. And so, like, there's this balance between the creative process and, like, the stories that creators have inside themselves and want to get out versus design by committee.
Yeah.
Which, you know, can be good, but also can take things to weird or less emotionally compelling places for the sake of fitting everything in.
Right. Last couple questions of my own. Biggest flim-flam about fandom. Any myths that you would like to get on a soapbox and bust?
That it's only for teenage girls. Conversely, that teenage girl taste doesn't matter.
Right.
Like, how can this be such an important cultural phenomenon and discount one of the loudest contingencies of it? If I could soapbox forever, it would be like teen girl taste matters to what actually becomes popular and commercially viable in this and other countries. So I think it's like derision of teen girl taste. I really hate it when talk show hosts drag out fan fiction and fan art as like a tool for embarrassment of the actors in an IP.
Oh, that sucks.
I hate that. It wasn't written for you. And so like there's that. There's also the assumption, like in my job, and I get this a lot, is like, oh, you study fandom, so you must study the fandom that I'm in. And that is absolutely not the case. Like, I did not grow up in like emo bandom. Like, I can't tell you about the culture of My Chemical Romance fans. I know they exist. That's the extent of my knowledge. And so it's really easy to have the fallacy of, well, fandom only exists in my experience of fandom, which is not the case, because the experience of being a fan is just like just as diverse as the people who are fans of stuff.
I imagine you must have heard a lot about really upset Game of Thrones fans who are just like, well, I'm done now. Done forever.
Yeah. When fans willfully break
and
are like, nope, this is not part of my identity anymore. Not realizing that like hating on something is still a form of fandom because you're still caring. Like,
yeah.
The opposite of love isn't hate, it's apathy.
But mostly I hate the way I don't hate you. Not even close. Not even a little bit. Not even at all.
Is that what you hate the most about your job? Not Game of Thrones, but people having assumptions about it? Or what's the worst thing about being a fanthropologist?
Probably that people have a very monolithic understanding of fandom and really want to define it however they went into it. Like, it's hard to broaden horizons is the hardest part and worst part about my job, because it's so tied to identity, either on the production side or the consumption side. Like, change is hard and slow, and there's a lot of risk aversion is probably the hardest part about my job, is convincing people to, one, take risks, and two, have empathy for the other parts of the process.
So a lot of us think we know what fandom is and entails, but fanthropologists know that identity and self-care and brand loyalty and exploring your own faults through fiction is very complicated, which is why fanthropology is fascinating. What about the best? What's the coolest part? Is it all the free lanyards you get and going to conventions when there's not a plague?
I think it's just opening my eyes to what other people like and are interested in. I get to see so many facets of the cultural landscape that I, because I work in the private sector, not in academia, my research is dictated by my clients, not my personal research interests. And so I get to explore all sorts of other worlds that I would otherwise consider myself too old for or too young for, or would not normally gravitate towards it, or any other number of traits. So I get to see a much wider version of culture than most people's individual feeds would feed them.
How do you feel when people tell you that they're a big fan of you?
Doesn't happen a lot. I'm one of those professionals that, like, I know what it takes to be famous and build a brand on the internet, and I have actively and deliberately chosen not to do that for myself.
Nah, man.
And what do you tell people who are like, hey, my niece wants to be internet famous? And you're like, oh yeah, I hold the keys to that in a little box. What do you tell people?
I think, well, okay, so if your niece wants to be internet famous, I would say that they need to figure out what they like to make.
Mm-hmm.
And then make a lot of it. Like, make a lot and understand what about it they like, what about it they don't like. Get help where they can in the stuff that they don't like doing. And spend a lot of time watching stuff that they like for the express purpose of understanding why they like it. A lot of creative professionals spend a lot of their time consuming other people's content in order to look at it with a critical eye.
Mm-hmm.
So in the age of the internet, it's like, well, what is unique to you and what do you want to borrow from other stuff you like?
Mm-hmm.
And having that blend of unique to you and borrowed such that it is familiar is really, really important in that beginning stages, as is knowing what you want out of being a creator. Like, are you doing this because you want to be famous? But do you want to be famous because it's sometimes a proxy for having financial stability? Like, drill down into the why that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you want to have fun and communicate the having fun part? Is it about having freedom of expression, or is it about financial stability, or is it about personal growth needs, like learning how to develop a skill? Why are you doing this? What do you like about the content that you consume? And make a lot of it and understand how to tweak the stuff that you're making if you want to grow. Like, because if you want to be a professional, you have to scale to a size that can sustain being a professional. But if you just want to make stuff to make stuff, then make stuff and make a lot of it. And practice and build those skills. Skill stack.
Skill. Oh, that's such good advice. That's going to change at least one listener's life, I'm sure. Which is so exciting. That's like literally like the end scene of Pulp Fiction with the briefcase. You're like, here's what's in it, guys. Oh my God.
That's what's in it.
I in no way did I intend to make this a 2-hour interview, and I'm so thankful you stuck around. This looks like it's gonna be a 2-parter, I'm sure. This has just been so exciting. Ever since I was handed your business card, it has been on my desk for probably a year. So I'm so excited to finally talk to you.
Likewise. Can I give you my interview questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, Allie, what do you consider yourself to be a fan of?
Oh, okay. Things I'm a fan of. I think that I'm the biggest like stan of probably Fiona Apple. I think that if I were to ever meet her, I think, and I have met her very briefly, and I don't even think I said a sentence. I think I just was like, blip, 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 blip. She was like in a lobby leaving an event as I was coming in. I think that that would be probably someone that I have so much awe and respect for, and whose music and words and mission and ethos have meant probably the most to me over time. Probably. Yeah. She's someone who just now I'm never disappointed by her.
What is your earliest memory of being a fan of anything?
Okay. All right. Do you want to know my first cosplay?
Yes.
Okay. I was the youngest of three girls. And I also is the youngest. Like, just I watched way too stuff that was inappropriate for my age because my sisters were older. So like tons of R movies when I was just barely in kindergarten. It was just like they'd be on cable. And so but we would watch Escape from New York too much. And when I was 5 or 6, really was excited about dressing up like Snake Plissken. So I cut off the arms of a shirt into like a muscle tank. And I made a rubber eye patch out of an old bike tire. And then also took my mom's, she was not happy about it, but I took her eyeshadow and made a 5 o'clock shadow.
Call me Snake.
And I was like, in bliss. And I think we may have had a toy gun, but I just remember marching around the backyard being like, I am Snake Plissken. I'm not dressed as Snake Plissken. Right now, I am Snake Plissken of Escape from New York, played by Kurt Russell in a post-apocalyptic world. And there's somewhere there exists a Polaroid of it. And it's one of those treasures that if my family, if we ever find it, oh my God, the bounty I would pay. Oh, yeah, that was me at my most badass. I peaked.
Thanks so much for taking like more than an hour.
Oh, I love this. Are you kidding? I was like, as soon as you were like, I don't have anywhere to be, I was like, game on.
So what is the lesson here, y'all? Ask smart, passionate people
about the smart, passionate people they study. Study people who study people who study characters. And cut bangs if you want them. And just make a lot of stuff. Just make things. Get dirty, be weirder than you think is okay to be. Meanwhile, follow at Meredith Jean on Twitter. She's also on Clubhouse, where she's been leading discussions on things like fandom and the attention economy. You can follow me, if you like, at Allie Ward with one L on Twitter and Instagram. We're also at Ologies on both. You can join the Facebook Ologies podcast group. Thank you, Aaron Talbert, for adminning that. You can find other Ologites in the wild with merch at ologiesmerch.com. Thank you, Shannon Feltis and Bonnie Dutch of the comedy podcast You Are That for managing all that. Thank you, Noelle Dilworth, for keeping the whole ship running. Thanks, Emily White and all the transcribers for making transcripts available on our website at allieward.com/ologiesextras. There's a link for those for free in the show notes, as well as bleeped episodes. Thank you, Caleb Patton, for bleeping them. And thank you to editors Jarrett Sleeper, Mega Hunk, who hosts Quarantine Calisthenics every weekday at 9 a.m. Pacific on Twitch, and to Jurassic Park fanatic and kitty lover Stephen Ray Morris of the podcast See Jurassic Right and the Purrcast, and a new Everything But the Movie, a Star Wars books podcast. Nick Thorburn of the very good band Islands wrote and played the theme music. They have a new album due out in June. Exciting. And at the end of each episode, I tell a secret. And this week, it's not very juicy, but it's something I think about all day, every day. There's this long strip of plastic tangled in my neighbor's eucalyptus tree, and it's probably like 15 or 20 feet in the air. And I see it whipping in the wind every day. And I think, should I risk breaking several femurs to just go remove that? Because it bums me out, and I keep staring at it, and I keep thinking, how am I going to get that thing down? So stay tuned. I got to do something. Anyway, okay, I'm a fan of you. Bye-bye.
Pachydermatology, homeology, cryptozoology. Lithology, nanotechnology, meteorology, olfactology, nephology, seriology, selenology.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.